Welcome to The Hobcast, a weekly podcast from Hoback Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of building a new creative business in this pandemic world. We'll hear from the people who make all this possible, the authors, cover designers, and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on The Hobcast from Hoback Books, as we combined trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
And welcome again to The Hobcast. We have reached show number 37. And we have a wonderful guest this week. Kate Bendelow is not only an author, she is a serving scene of crimes officer for Greater Manchester Police. And what she doesn't know about forensic science and dealing with a scene of crime isn't worth knowing after 19 years on the force. It's a fantastic interview, full of depth and it's quite a graphic interview, as you can imagine, because, you know, we're not dealing with nice things, but Kate is wonderful. And so we look forward to speaking to her a little bit later in the programme.
It was probably, for me, it's one of the most interesting, just in terms of we haven't spoken to anyone who deals on that side of crime before. And I just love the sort of matter-of-fact way she's able to talk about it. And we did talk about her job quite a lot, actually, didn't we? It was fascinating.
Yeah, coping strategies when you're faced with some incredibly and unexpected grisly scenes. You know, you just can't predict what you're going to find. And then the care with which you've got to treat not only the victims, but also the scene.
So, you have to have a sort of a scientific mind and be able to sort of compartmentalise things. But you also need to have an emotional side to you. I think, you know, there's a lot of skills you have to draw on in that job, which I hadn't quite thought through myself.
No, indeed. So a hugely revelatory interview with Kate Bendelow a little bit later. Now, it's The Hobcast, which is, of course, the podcast arm of Hoback Books. And we are independent UK producers and publishers of the following genres.
Crime.
Mystery.
Thrillers.
Suspense.
Now, I was doing someone who's lost their voice, not because I've lost my voice, but you're kind of on the verge of losing your voice.
I'm not well as we record this. And in fact, we had a fairly healthy debate as to whether we were going to not bother, but obviously we enjoy making the programme, but whether in fact I could possibly do it, because let's be honest, when one comes down with symptoms like a temperature, a regular cough, and there's other bits and bobs, you know, your immediate assumption is that you've got it.
And there's me in a little box quite close to you.
Yeah, we're filtering the air, but nonetheless, it's a bit difficult. I mean, you know, I've started feeling symptoms about 48 hours ago. Wrote off most of yesterday. I managed to get some work done, some audio editing. But in terms of recording, forget it. I mean, my voice is. I did a long session on Friday. Excuse me. That wasn't for effect. And I'd probably recorded 4.5 hours of audio, which is on the upper limit of my stamina. And then I just took to bed after that. I was wiped.
He did. And he slept for about 4 hours. I couldn't believe it. But, I mean, that's the problem you have with the sort of narration side of what you do, that if that goes wrong, your voice goes wrong, there's nothing you can do.
No. I mean, you know, it happens to be that there's an absolutely massive backlog of editing to do as well on two projects that I'm recording concurrently and projects that we've got other people have worked on, so we've got the work of Judy Dakin narrating Blood Loss by Karina Swan, and also Alison Morgan. I beg your pardon. Alison Mitchell is a former colleague of mine who commentates on cricket for Radio 5. Alison Morgan's throttled as well, and to be honest, you know. Much to their frustration, my editing pace has been glacial. So I do apologise. But as I've always said, the audiobook business, you know, the recording is only one thing. The editing is an altogether different experience, and it takes forever to get it right. And so that's where I'm battling away at the moment. But as you can hear, my voice is cracking up. We haven't even introduced ourselves.
Who are we? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm Adrian Hobart, what's left of me. And you are?
I'm 100% Rebecca Collins.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Listen, publishing news. We didn't have a lot last week, did we? We were at Bloody Scotland.
No. I mean, I think Bloody Scotland was enough publishing news for one week anyway, because there was such a lot going on there. But a couple of things caught my eye. So one of them is crime fiction related. This Halloween, we're publishing a book at Halloween, aren't we? We're publishing Wailing Babes by Judy Dakin, which isn't crime as such, even though she's a crime writer. It's actually an anthology of interlinked ghost stories. But also this Halloween, there's a group of crime writers who've come together to publish a crime anthology to help raise funds for Barnardo's. So included are Peter James, M.W. Craven, whose wife recently won one of our competitions.
Joe, yeah.
T.M. Logan and Trevor Wood. Trevor Wood is a UEA MA crime fiction graduate. So, you know, there's sort of a link there. And I don't know. I like when they do these sort of things and they come together and they do it just, you know, for a good cause. So I'm going to look forward to
it. Actually, the story's just occurred to me that that will appeal to you. I don't know if you saw it this week, but your favourite Man United player.
Oh, I've got quite a few favourites. Is it Malcolm Rutherford.
Malcolm Rutherford, as you know him, or the rest of us mistakenly understand as being Marcus Rashford.
That's why I got confused, because people keep saying Marcus.
He's been added to the syllabus for English language exams because of the persuasive power of his tweets, which changed government policy. And so kids are now going to look at the social media posts that he used to improve the school's meal situation. And now, of course, he's working on a literacy side as well. So that's interesting. I think that's, you know, it's fascinating, the power of someone of his ilk. I mean, he was absolutely adamant that he wasn't going to back down and let the government off the hook. And, you know, subsequently he's faced flack from right-wing commentators about it. But, you know, it's one of those unarguable things. Kids need to eat. And he made sure that during the lockdown, you know, kids who weren't getting school meals were getting some decent nutrition. Nothing wrong with that. But the other thing that he's, of course, been criticised for was missing a penalty in the final of Euro 2020. So I think it's almost like a backlash in that regard. But, yeah, I thought that was an interesting...
I think it's interesting. I mean, the power of social media is, you know, it fascinates me anyway, because if somebody well-known tweets something, it can just explode. It depends on who the person is. It depends on what it is. But I think in the case of Malcolm Rutherford, it's partly because he's been there. So he's not just pontificating from above, you know, like we've had celebrities who say, oh, yeah, we should do all this to encourage reading. We should do this. But he's actually been in that situation. So he's incredibly credible, if I can say that. So, yeah, and I can see why the schools would want you to study that, because the power of social media, as we know as publishers, it can make a massive difference. And kind of related to that is I've just today actually started trying to get into TikTok. I signed us up for TikTok about 2 months ago and then just left it because I didn't understand it.
But, I still don't.
But one of our authors, Jenny Insall, said we've just made a promo video for her book Silence, which is coming out in December. And she said it was 1 minute, 2 seconds long. And she said, take off 2 seconds and you can put it on TikTok. And I said, well, we have no followers on TikTok and I don't know how to use it. And she sent me a really interesting article about book promotion on TikTok. You don't need followers. If you just put all the right hashtags in, lots of people will be served your video. And the more people that served it and liked it and blah, 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 you know, usual happens.
The quicker it spreads.
So yesterday I posted one of our videos, not Jenny's, a different one, and it's had 600 people view it already in a day. I don't know who these people are, but if they all buy the book, happy days.
Awesome.
So that's the power of social media.
Well, let's hope so. Let's hope so. Any other stories? I mean, I'm looking at the official top 50, and it won't surprise you to learn there is a new number one in the UK book charts.
Can I guess what it is?
You may.
Is it by a really tall chap?
Yes.
Does he own a Hoback mug?
Yes.
I'm guessing it's the man who died twice?
Well, Has Richard Osman died twice? That's the name of the book. Yeah, Richard Osman is the second of the stories, you know, the Thursday Murder Club follow-up, if you like, and it's gone straight to number one. No big surprise. It sold 1.4 million copies in its first, you know, the first book in this country. So, but what's interesting is that there are six new entries in the top 10.
Okay.
And most of those are written by
Richard Osman?
celebrity authors.
Now, that leads very interestingly into another story.
Shall I just say who they are?
Okay,
first,
go on, then, go on.
And then we'll move on. Well, Bob Mortimer's number two with his...
Oh, his fishing book, is it?
I think it's his autobiography.
Oh.
it's called Underwear. I've done the accent for you there. So Sally Rooney's been shunted down to number four with Beautiful
shocking.
World, Where Are You?
Which I haven't actually read yet, but
because
I have
Richard Osman is at number three with Thursday Murder Club.
Mm.
And then guess who's coming at number five? Jamie Oliver with Together, which is his pandemic cookbook. Brilliant.
Together.
And then other well-known names. Well, the only other one that really stands out for me is Miriam Margolyes. And that is her autobiography, This Much Is True. And it's pretty... Miriam Margolyes?
Is she a golfer?
No. She's an actress.
Oh. It just sounds like a golfing name.
I don't know what she was in Harry Potter, but she's been in that. She's been in loads and loads of things. She's in lots. She's always the sort of... How do I put this without being rude? She's always the comic turn, the frumpy comic
like
turn.
Like Sue Pollard?
Well, a little bit, you know. But she's sort of kind of that sort of hyper-mumsy kind of character that always turns up in something that has Judi Dench or Helen Mirren in it.
Oh, okay. I've just never heard of her.
No, she's pretty... Well, the rest of the world's heard of her. Don't worry about that. But she has basically not held back. And there's an awful lot of people taking cover with what she said about them. So it's one of those. Yeah, so she's really, you know...
Warts and all.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, 100%. So that's got a lot of traction in the papers the last few days.
Yes. So, yes, that reminds me of another news story, which I've actually dropped on the floor, so let me just pick it up.
Is that good, folks? You're listening to The Hobcast as Rebecca picks up her pieces of paper very quietly, as you can hear. Right.
Right. So the MD of Simon & Schuster Children's Books is Rachel Denwood. And recently she spoke out at the Booksellers Children's Conference about this whole sort of cult of celebrities publishing books. I mean, of course, she was specifically talking about celebrities writing children's books. There are a lot of them at the moment, mm-hmm. aren't there? Dermot O'Leary's written some books about cats. I don't know if you've heard about those.
No, I just try and ignore the whole... It's a part of the industry I'm just not interested in.
And then, of course, we've got David Walliams, you know, who's been very successful. And, you know, I'm not disputing his talent. I've read one of his books with the boys.
Well, I am disputing his talent. Yeah. I mean, look, he's got like a hard circuit into the brains of, you know, prepubescent children in the way that his humour is, it's Roald Dahl without the skill.
Without the depth. It's like surface Roald Dahl, I'd call it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you can't dispute that it has had an appeal.
Oh, no, I mean, sold
it's a bit like
trillions of
Captain
of
Underpants, that sort of thing, you know.
Yeah, I quite enjoy those. Is that Jeremy Peace? Was it who wrote that?
Or I can't
Jeremy
remember,
Strong.
Actually.
Jeremy Strong.
Jeremy Strong, that's it.
Yeah.
But the point of this was that she's saying that publishers, although, you know, it's a in terms of profit, it's a dead cert, isn't it? A celebrity comes to you with a reasonably well written book, you're going to sell it. You're going to make a lot of money. But she's saying, but they mustn't forget about new talent. They need to put just as much backing and just as much effort into new talent because otherwise, you know, the sort of the creative soup, as we call it, will be just chunks of meat and no veggie.
I think there is a problem with the cult of celebrity trumping everything at the moment. And I actually think that, well, I've heard that from colleagues of mine who are writing children's books that I used to work with at the BBC, Dan Walker being one and Ori Aduba being another.
Is that the dancing bloke?
Dan Walker, yeah, they're both dancing blokes because Ori won the whole thing 2 or 3 years ago. They've both been, you know, writing children's books as well. Look, I mean, the fact is that people are being approached to do it. They're not actually going out writing them and then hoping.
Oh.
They're basically fronting, and a lot of it's sort of the hard lifting is done by other people.
The editing.
Yeah. No, I mean the writing.
Oh, well, okay.
You know, and the celebrity, I mean, look, do you think Katie Price has written one of her books? Don't think
she's so. She's a very intelligent woman.
She's got bestsellers.
She was on MasterChef.
Yeah, she's many things. But, I mean, the bottom line is that those have been ghostwritten. And, you know, the thing that the celebrity brings is their name. And it's getting harder and harder. But actually, I would say, look, you know, yes, of course, we've got to look for new talent. And we're looking for new talent at the moment. Just to remind you, you have a week to get your submissions in, less than a week. For this year's opening of the Hoback submissions, we've had, you know, absolutely.
I think it's 50 now.
Yeah, it's a lot. And given that we're going to read them all, both of us, and offer a degree of feedback, it's going to be a long process. But we've been blown away by some of the names that have come forward. Anyway, that aside, we're always looking for new talent. But actually, what's important is to nurture the people who've been around a bit but aren't as big a name as.
So the middle.
The middle, yeah, the middle ground. No one ever talks about them. The meek.
No.
Oh, they're doing something for the meek, you know. Do you know what I mean? You know, oh, that's nice. The meek, you know. Sorry, it's the life of Brian.
I know.
Badly remembered. But
consider the lilies.
It's all very well for the publishing industry because it's easy to go for someone new and give them three books in the spotlight and then drop them. And it's easy to find a new slew of celebrities. I mean, we have to wait for Celebrity Love Island and various other, you know, outlets to make stars of someone.
Mm.
And then, you know, you've got new talent from there, inverted commas. But the bottom line is there are a lot of really talented authors who are falling out of the nest in the traditional publishing world.
And getting quite disillusioned as well. I mean, I know that quite a few are actually turning to self-publishing.
Yeah, they are. All coming to us.
Well,
which is flattering. But anyway,
have 4 days left.
Yeah, I think we'll leave the news there and we'll get into the interview with Kate Bendler because my throat is absolutely raw now. As you may hear, it's getting a little throaty. Anyway, Kate Bendler is it was a wonderful interview, and you know we say this every week when we speak to someone. There's so much we get out of the format, if you like, by giving people 40, 45 minutes to tell their story. It's you get so much depth, but this is one that I'm sure everyone who listens to it will remember. Kate Bendler, a serving senior crimes officer for the last 19 years for Greater Manchester Police, and also a successful crime author in her own right. So she's written books on forensics for raw authors, but also
her own fiction.
Crime. Yeah, her own fiction. So she has a lot to offer in this wonderful interview with Kate Bendler.
Kate Bendler, thank you so much for joining us on the Hobcast Book Show.
Thank you for having me on. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Fantastic. Now, listen, we're not recording in video, but for those who can't see it, you've got a fantastic bookshelf behind you, including, unless I'm very much mistaken, your own novel.
Yep. Definitely Dead, the first in the Socko Maya Barton series. It was brought out by Bloodhound. It was published in May of this year. And the second book, Shattered Bones, is being published on the 25th of October.
Wow. So that's always a nervous time, isn't it? I mean, we release books every couple of weeks and, you know, we share the nerves of the authors. But book one, how has it received so far?
I'm really, really pleased. I've had some fantastic reviews and some really, really good feedback about it. So, yeah, it's been nerve-wracking. It's not the first book I've written. You might know I wrote a non-fiction book, The Real CSI, a forensic handbook for crime writers. As much as I love that book and I was so proud of it, I always said I wouldn't feel like a real author until I had my fiction book published. So yeah, it was, as you say, massively nerve-wracking time. Sort of reading reviews is difficult, but yeah, it's been very well received up to now, so I'm really pleased with it.
So have you always wanted to write a fiction book then?
Yeah, always. That was always my intention when I first started writing. The non-fiction book came about really by chance. When I went to Swanwick Writers Summer School in 2014. While I was there, there were a presentation by Derbyshire Police who was sort of talking through crime writers, how a murder investigation is carried out. And whilst it was a very good course, I was sat listening to it as a CSI, a serving CSI, and a writer, thinking, I can see what they're doing from a police perspective, but I can see where it's not really giving writers all the information they need. It needs to be a bit deeper. So I volunteered the next year to go back and run a course, just describing forensic techniques for crime writers. And then on the back of that, the course was so well received, it was overwhelming. People suggested I write the book, which I did. So yeah, I always wanted to write, but never intended to write non-fiction. So that sort of came across by accident, if you will. I accidentally wrote a book.
That's a good way to do it, isn't it? I want to accidentally write a book now.
Well, I think it's wonderful because, I mean, a book like yours has made a big difference, I think, to crime writers, particularly in the UK, because the one thing that I think most crime writers are terrified of is not being credible.
Absolutely, yeah.
And but, I mean, at the same time, we were at Bloody Scotland just this weekend up in Stirling, and
of course,
we had Chris Brookmeyer talking about he was with Mark Billing and two of the best crime authors in the country, talking about some of the criticism they get, and he was saying that quite a few people who have some interest in whatever subject they're writing, you know, write in and say, well, you got that wrong, and if particularly around the sort of forensic side of things.
Yeah.
And he said, look, hang on a second. I'm an author. I'm a fiction author. Surely I'm allowed some license to make, you know, stretch the truth a little bit. But I think that there is this debate, isn't there, that, between, telling a really rollicking good story, but also saying the right side of the science, the fact,
absolutely,
the procedure.
Yeah. Absolutely, and it is a fine line. And there's so many really, really good books that I've read and thoroughly enjoyed, but there has been like a forensic sort of mishap, if you like, something that has been described that just wouldn't happen, and it does make me roll my eyes and gnash my teeth. But then I think it depends, really. It doesn't, if the story's good, it doesn't massively detract from the stories. For example, I love, because I love Idris Elba, I loved Luther. I thought Luther was fantastic. Forensically, it was completely off the mark. I remember one episode in particular when Luther rolls up at the crime scene and he goes, "Is Socco done?" "Yes, boss, it just left." Then he walks in the room and the body's still there. Now, I might have left a lens cap for my camera at a crime scene before now, but I've never, ever left a body. And again, although it's annoying and it's frustrating, and it's so easily researched, that sort of thing, there's lots of people out there who are happy to speak to crime writers and TV producers and what have you and help them get it right. And like I say, it didn't distract because it was brilliant storyline, so it didn't detract me. It's just a little bit annoying. And I think the odd little bit of getting it wrong isn't such a big problem, but I think particularly with the crime genre, because it's such a saturated area of crime writing, of readers that like it, don't insult your readers, do a little bit of research and get it right. I read recently something by an author who I'll not name, but I admire greatly, who she mentioned something about not doing too much research to check the accuracy because they felt it detracted from the plot. And I think that's a little bit of a cop-out, really. I think if you have respect for your readers, do the research and just make sure, at least give a nod to it being in the right direction.
I think it's about getting the balance right, isn't it? Because
it is, absolutely.
I mean, Graham Bartlett said something similar. Yeah. He was talking about line of duty. And, was saying in some way he can't watch it because he can spot everything that's wrong. But, if they sort of get the balance between having a certain degree of accuracy and credibility, but it's still got to be drama because
one of our authors
also said, Brian Price, I think it was, he said that if you had the time scale of real life forensics,
it
would go on for months.
It would, absolutely it would. There are certain things you have to judge. And again, Line of Duty, I think, is a perfect example. I absolutely loved it. I know Graham had his issues with it, but he say he's getting the drama right, because I know there was one part in Line of Duty where they were doing the interview and they'd attended one of the suspects' houses the night before, and they'd recovered DNA, and the DNA results had come back instantly. It wouldn't happen in real life, but you need it for that, to keep that drama and that flow. And it's one of the things that I found really too much knowledge is a dangerous thing. And I know I've struggled with it in my own writing, where I've sort of thought, oh, no, I'm really going to have to sort of push this, or work a way around how my characters are going to deal with how we would do things in real life. But yeah, if you were to document in detail, I mean, my first draft of Definitely Dead was, I think it was sort of topping War and Peace with a word count, because I'd gone on to forensic overload. And I think there was more fact in that first draft than there was probably in the whole of the real CSI. And it is a case of having to hold back a little bit. But let's say the drama's got to be the key thing. The story is the key thing. So, yeah, there's always a bit of a compromise, I think, as long as it's, like I say, you're respectful to your readers.
I think there's this moan that goes up amongst crime writers, in a sense, that they long to go back to the golden age where, Poirot could walk in a room and, you know, two or three sort of tiny clues could be enough to solve a case.
Yeah. And then no CCTV, no DNA.
No mobile phones, no access to the internet.
Just a hunch. That's all he needed was a hunch.
Right.
Absolutely.
So... Oh, thank you. I've just been presented with a blackberry.
No, a mulberry.
A mulberry from
my mother's
mulberry tree. Yeah, she might need to enjoy herself. So this is how these interviews go. We'll have an off interruption. But anyway, this is the Hobcast, if you weren't aware. This is Kate Bendelow that we're speaking to. Real life forensics expert and senior crimes officer for Greater Manchester Police. Yeah. But yeah, the moan that people have within the crime community is technology and forensic advances and the ability of the police to use all sorts of new methodology that wasn't there even 20 years ago, even 5 years ago, means that it's much harder for the criminal to get away with it in fiction, if you're doing it accurately, for very long. Do you have any sympathy with that sort of thing? You know, that, for instance, authors seem to somehow always contrive to make sure that the protagonist loses their phone as soon as possible.
Absolutely, you know, absolutely. I do have a lot of sympathy for it, and as I say, that is actually something I really, really struggled with in my second book, the second Maya Barton book. I had a real issue with one of my main protagonists, thinking, "Oh no!" And you know, it didn't occur to me until I was sort of halfway through the first draft, and I suddenly thought, "I've got to get rid of this phone somehow." It occurred to me that he would have a phone, and I'm thinking, I have to get rid of it. And yeah, I really scratched my head with that. And then you can write yourself so much into a corner. CCTV, again, was problematic in book two, but then I managed to turn that, throw a plot line in that, work that to my advantage. But it is so, so difficult. I mean, I have actually thought, ideally, I would like to go back to maybe writing a book that was set in the 80s for the reasons you've mentioned. You know, it would be a lot easier. It's hard for crime writers. It really, really is. Obviously, as a CSI, it's a dream for me. All the CCTV we have, or like you say, all the work we can do with computers, phones, DNA, fingerprints, etc. But yeah, for a crime writer, it's not good. I do envy Agatha Christie. She had it easy, let's face it.
She did. Yeah, you know, put a vicar, a retired colonel, a damsel in distress, and a couple of other figures, and you've got a plot, really, haven't you? And a caddish millionaire.
And now they'd be putting it all on Instagram, doing selfies, and then you see the murder in the background.
No, let's get into your career then, prior to the writing side of things. I mean, what attracted you to become, you know, a forensics officer, you know, and work in that field? Because it's a very specialized thing, and it takes a special kind of person to survive that environment, I imagine.
Special kind of weirdo, I think you're trying to politely articulate there. So, I've been with Greater Manchester Police as a crime scene investigator now for 19 years. Mm-hmm. I originally wanted to be a police officer, but at the time, my unaided eyesight was way below standards. I wore glasses, and I've had laser surgery since then. Wore glasses at the time, and my unaided eyesight was basically blind as a bat. So I was absolutely devastated when I realised I'd sort of fallen at the first hurdle and wasn't going to get in the job. I was working for Greater Manchester Police at the time in finance, and my boss said to me, just go to personnel, speak to them, there must be other jobs out there that you can do. And I'd never heard of the calls. We were referred to still then the old term of sock holds, which are still used, which is seen a crime officer. I'd never heard of the sock hold job, but the moment she told me about it, that was it. I was hooked. I studied photography at night school and applied with a photography qualification. You don't need to have a degree to do my job. We do have some people who do study forensics at university and get in that way. Other people who've got background, scientific background, or have done criminology. It's a sort of job really where I think it's more down to your personality, being able to talk to anybody at varying ranks in sometimes really, really stressful, highly emotional circumstances. Obviously strong stomachs needed. And just really innate ability just to sort of spot, to sort of work a crime scene. And it's so almost like a gut instinct that you sort of know sometimes, not just finding clues that are there, but also noticing what could be missing, what isn't there. The job, I mean, I love the job. It's the best job in the world. There can be times though when you're working a long protracted crime scene when it can become very, very tedious. It's back-breaking, it's laborious. You're working in not pleasant circumstances, but yeah, I can't see myself doing anything else. I absolutely love it. And I'm fortunate that I'm part-time, so I've got the best of both worlds. I can do my job and write as well. So my two favourite things, basically.
And you can call your job your research.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm, you know, thinking back those 19 years then, attending your first murder scene, I mean, what sort of goes, I mean, because you read sometimes fiction about people, you know, new to the job going in, you know, young detectives going in for the first time and not coping. Yeah. But I mean, how did you feel? What apprehension did you feel going in there?
Absolutely terrified, because the level of responsibility that, you know, you're here, you're doing this job, you've got to get it right. There's no option to fail or make a mistake. That is really overwhelming. The other thing is as well, is when you arrive at a crime scene, the first thing everybody wants to know is how long you're going to be. And that pressure, when you've constantly got that, whether that's your crime scene manager ringing saying, where are you up to, how are you doing, or the SIO is, either in or other cops to chase. I mean, even the police officer on the crime scene can, and I appreciate it's tedious and laborious and boring for them, but I've worked a scene recently where I arrived and got suited up, walked in the address, took initial photographs, came back out, and you went, oh, have you done now? And I'm like, oh, I'll be done for some days at least. And every time I came out, he kept saying, have you done now? And it was getting very, very tedious. So yeah, that pressure, I remember that from my first job as well. It was very much a case of, well, how long will he be? That pressure is quite overwhelming. But then you quickly become engrossed in what you're doing, and you don't have time really to think about anything else, to think about how that body makes you feel. It's just the whole process. You just become engrossed in the process, and that's sort of your motivation, if you like, to get done what you need to do. It's usually only afterwards when you start to digest what you've seen and what you've done, and a bit of a come down afterwards. That can be quite hard, actually. Nobody sort of prepares you for that. Nobody certainly warned me about that when I first started, that, you know, you've got to be working in this murder scene for maybe 6 days. So you don't prepare you for how it feels when you suddenly, you're done and dusted and you get home and life sort of has to go back to normal, but it can't be normal because you've already changed because of what you've experienced, if that makes sense.
Yes, yeah.
And your brain's processing it as well, isn't
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, yeah. It's a lack of decompression, I think, afterwards, that you suddenly do go home, or you might call to Tesco and you're walking around Tesco and you think, God, I've spent the last few days doing God knows what. And it's quite surreal. Obviously, it's something now, it's not a problem, but at first, say 12 months in the job, yeah, I did find that quite difficult to come to terms with.
I found that when I was a young journalist, and the older you get in journalism, the further away from the story you get, it tends to be. So when I was younger, yeah. I was going to, I've talked about it before on the podcast, you know, road traffic accidents and sometimes some pretty grisly stories, arson and whatever else. And some of the things that you experience live with you. And I used to find exactly that, you know, I'd go to Tesco and I'd see people enjoying their normal life, either argue with each other over what are they going to have for dinner or
which baguette.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you're just thinking, that is so minor compared to what I've just gone through. And
it's,
you feel out of step with the world. It takes about, I used to take me a couple of days really to tune in, especially when I was then having to go into the studios of the radio station where I was working and banter with the DJs.
Yeah.
You know, after the news, and they're sort of going, hi, great mates, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. And you're thinking, I've just been to an RTA where I've seen a headless corpse because the seatbelt on or something. And it's, I'm just now I've got to talk about the latest soap story or something.
Yeah.
It's very otherworldly, isn't it?
It is. It's a, because it's not normal, is it? Let's face it, seeing that sort of thing, as much as it becomes your bread and butter in your day to day, you have to appreciate the fact that it's not normal. And sometimes you do get an awakening to that. But then I think we couldn't have this conversation and not mention gallows humour, because that is a lifesaver. And that is why I think anyone certainly works in the emergency services and jobs like that, and probably yourself with your experiences, gallows humour is the greatest sort of, it sort of protects you in a way, because you laugh about what you've seen, and it's one way of coming to terms with it and digesting it and dealing with it and coping with it. And it's no disrespect whatsoever to that person you might be working with. It's not at all that, it's nothing detrimental to the deceased. You know, you've got respect for that body at all times, but it's just a coping mechanism. And, you know, they always say, don't you laugh at a funeral, you cry at a wedding. Sometimes death is funny. I mean, there are some situations I've been in where it's macabre, but it's also side-splittingly funny. Probably nothing I can share on this, but you do have to laugh. You really do.
No, I can well imagine. But then you see, I feel at the moment, and I've talked about this on the podcast, in fact, even in our last podcast with Tina Baker, that some of this gallows humour, some of the language that you would use in a group situation away from the scene, maybe, but back in the office, is under pressure culturally.
Absolutely.
You know, because younger people coming into the industry, so into your fields, who at the same stage you were 19 years ago, would blanch at the sort of gallows humour and find it disrespectful.
Absolutely. And sometimes I do. I'll be sort of having a conversation at home and I'll say something to my husband and I'll forget, one of my friends, and forget that I'm not with work people, I'm with normal people, if you will. And he'll suddenly look at me and like, what is wrong with you? And it is only like, there's only my workmates would understand certain stuff that you would share. When you suddenly realise when you're in polite conversation that maybe you've shared something that you should just be kept to the office, and people are looking at you, usually pale-faced or green around the gills, and sort of like, something wrong with you, there really is.
But the irony is, though, that without the gallows humour, it could affect you more.
It would without a doubt. Like I say, for me, it's a coping mechanism, and it's a way of processing what you've seen, and it's something I hope I've got across as well in the Maya Barton books, that as much as she's dealing with sort of these awful deaths and difficult situations, that there is very much, especially when it comes to a bantering with the colleagues, which is more in book two, that is, it reflects real life. It reflects how it would be for me working with my colleagues or in the office or working at a job.
I've always been intrigued. I think you touched on it earlier, going into a scene, the methodology, the importance of correct procedure, because, you know, at the end of it, this could be admissible evidence, or indeed could be the way that somebody who has committed a crime could get off it because of the way that, you know, someone missteps in the crime scene and contaminates it in some way.
Yeah.
Does that weigh heavy when you're going in?
It can do. I mean, the first step we always do is crime prevention. My COVID brain fog's just come down again. crime scene preservation is essential, yes. And that's the first thing we will always, always make sure we do. And that's one of the reasons why, obviously, we're going wearing our silly white suits and masks and double gloves and stuff. We'll use stepping plates. We'll use the yellow scene markers to highlight evidence that's in there. And the main thing as well, and this is something which a lot of crime writers get wrong, is be aware that your crime scene belongs to the crime scene investigator. So you won't get a rogue detective going in there having a mooch about and picking stuff up. And you know,
they always do that, though, don't they?
They always do it. And you always see them with a pen as well. The pen that they've been chewing on will suddenly start mauling with things. And, you know, that wouldn't happen. And in real life, we wouldn't sort of have a detective just randomly wandering around our crime scene. We have
lifting the tape up.
Basically. The tape, the crime scene tape, drives me insane. Honestly, you would be surprised by how many members of the public are crime scene tape blind. And you know, you've probably seen it yourself when there's like road closed and police line do not cross, and the number of people who go, "Can I not come through, love?" No, you can't. It clearly says crime scene do not cross. So yeah, that's problematic when you're working on something outside. You will always try and get people who, and obviously as well, today's generation, everyone's got a phone, everybody wants to video something that's going on. That gets really, really annoying as well. And that you don't have that sort of privacy, and you have to be very mindful if you're having a briefing outside, that usually you have to take it to a car, inside a car or a van, because people can be filming you and overhearing. So yeah, there are always usually problems, but nothing we can't usually overcome.
I've got to ask, as a former member of the press, how much of a pain are we when we turn up?
Oh, Adrian, I'm gonna have to be really, really polite now.
No, you don't need to be.
I've met some journalists who have been very, very respectful. I've also met some who have gone too far the other way and are not, and they become very, very intrusive. They will bend over backwards to try and get a photograph, which I don't understand why, because I think even if you do, say if we're pulling a body out of the canal, I think even if you do photograph it, you're not then going to be able to print that on
your
website and stuff. It can be very, very problematic, because I remember once we were doing a body recovery of a chap from the canal, and because the press were on the scene, and we're there with the cameras and everything and the video equipment, we had to utilise one of our body sheets to cover up as we were removing him from the water, obviously for his, you know, give him some respect and some privacy. And those body sheets aren't, you know, that's a piece of kit that costs quite a lot of money. And then it's wasted, then you can't reuse that. So it can be annoying. Sometimes it can be intrusive. I think it's a personality thing, isn't it? Like any job. And I appreciate they've got a job to do, but I have had some clashes in the past. Let's just say. Again, I think that's also probably reflected. I've vented my anger with that with a journalist that Maya meets in book one, Indefinitely Dead. So,
okay.
Yeah, it can be made difficult. It can be. But I say that the worst thing is as well is people with mobile phones who record things. And I think it sort of shows society's mindset, really, to death is cheap and means nothing. People are very, very voyeuristic. I know we probably always have been. I remember instances where we've had a chap who was on the wrong side of a motorway bridge and was going to jump off, and the police were trying to talk him down, and people were filming that and photographing that, and I just think we had a chap who drowned recently, and again people were recording that, and one guy even posted it on Twitter, and I just think it's so tasteless. There's no respect and there's no regard for that individual or their family. So yeah, that sort of thing gets me really, really mad and incredibly sweary.
And
I've not sworn, and we've had that conversation now, and I didn't utter a single expletive. I'm proud of myself.
I'm always proud of myself when I fail to. I mean, I have a certain reputation for being the Gordon Ramsay of BBC television. But what I find interesting with this is, you know, there is a sense that if you, I mean, we've heard this from authors before, for goodness sake, don't damage an animal in your books.
Oh,
because you know you can have as many brutal,
especially not cats,
twisted murders as you like.
I did.
Yeah.
Oh, have you?
Yeah.
And it's the one thing that triggers everybody, it seems.
I know, and I was very aware because I know it was a conversation I had once about Mark Billingham when he wrote, I can't remember the title of the book now, but it was based basically on the Croydon cat killer, and he was saying like the outrage and I'd seen myself on various sites, people saying, I read every single one of Billingham's books, but I'll not be reading that. And he was like, the fact that the book previous was all based on honour killings and nobody sort of raised an eyebrow. But yeah, I have committed the cardinal sin in book one, unfortunately. A cat does suffer. But it was quick and painless and, yeah, honestly.
Oh, well, that's all right then.
And I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm an animal lover myself, really. I adore animals and I can't countenance anybody who would, you know, harm like that, but I don't get the it's all right to kill people but don't harm the animals. No, it's a bit of a contentious issue, but yeah, I do find it a little strange, you know.
Oh, it's one of those rules, isn't it, that sort of crept in, really. And in terms of the taste and decency side of things. I mean, it's interesting you're talking about the respect you show the victims the corpses that you're dealing with, when you're on a scene, and in dignity, offering them in dignity in death that they perhaps didn't have in life at any stage, or indeed as they met their end. So in terms of when you're writing in that fiction side of it, what sort of line do you tread in terms of the detail, the graphic detail?
I try to keep it as accurate as I can because I think that's what people are interested in and what people want to read, and that's one thing I'm fortunate about, the experience I've got. I do want to share that. I hope I do it tastefully. And I'm sort of, maybe it's again my watch mind, but I don't think there's really a lot to do with it because it's a general, you know, the way bodies sort of decompose and stuff, it's nature, it's real thing, so I don't have a problem about writing that. I think the only thing I do find taboo that I don't like, and if I do spend a lot of time advising crime writers, but the one thing I sort of encourage people to steer away from is graphic sexual violence, any description of that, because I think it's, you know, there's a lot, I know for a fact there's a lot of people out there who are twisted minds, who that will sort of give them a thrill, if you like, for want of a better word. And also I am mindful of the fact that if somebody's suffered with that, then the last thing they want in the comfort of their own living room is to then read that and have that graphic description. I think it's a case of less is more, and if it is relevant to your storyline, you can suggest it's happened without going into that graphic detail. So that, for me, really, that's the only thing I do find taboo.
Yeah,
that's the only thing I wouldn't really write about. Bodies, I'll describe the bodies in graphic detail.
When I was younger, much, much younger, when I was a kid, in fact, I'm from Cambridge. We had Cambridge Christmas lectures laid on by the university, which were pretty wonderful. And I remember going to one spectacular talk, the most memorable I've ever been to, by Professor Austin Gresham, who literally wrote the book on 70s forensics, I gather, but was a home office pathologist as well as, you know, an expert. Yeah. And he didn't blanch showing kids as young as 8 years old the crime scene photographs of bodies found in woods 9 months after they've been murdered and this sort of thing. And I just remember this particular case he got very excited about. I mean, he was wearing a sticky bow, and he was your archetypal, late middle age professor with the leather patches.
Yeah, patches, yeah.
Bushy sideburns, slightly bald.
Yeah, crazy eyebrows.
Crazy eyebrows, exactly. And he got very excited. He goes, this one was a wonderful case. It's 9 months lying in the woods and it was in a terrible condition. Anyway, I looked at the skull, and there were three different holes in it. And then I couldn't figure out what would have created, you know, the impressions on the skull. And then he said, I was in Ridgeon's. I wonder if you know, it's a DIY store, I think is what they call them now. And I saw a tile hammer. And look, lo and behold, the three shapes were on the end of the tile hammer. And I knew it, Eureka! And I went round the store saying, I've solved it.
And it's that joy, isn't it? That sort of scientific joy.
Absolutely. So, yeah. I mean, I don't suppose you go back to the office going, I've solved it. I've solved it. But I mean, it was absolutely, you know, and actually, an ex-girlfriend of mine was at that same talk, and she decided that that's what she wanted to do. She ended up being a forensic accountant, slightly different, the forensic side stayed.
It is fascinating. It is fascinating. I mean, even, I say, I've been in 19 years, every now and then there's still a job that pops up that is, yeah, it does sort of, everyone will be around discussing it. And yeah, it really, really is. Going back to, like you say, though, sort of your experience with watching that talk, when I first started, we did used to show new SOCOs and new police officers. We used to show them photographic albums where we'd been to crime scenes where there were bodies. And the idea was, it wasn't voyeuristic, it was more to sort of help desensitize them a little bit before they saw the first body. To me, I thought it was a good thing to do. Unfortunately, that's not something we're allowed to do anymore.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
One thing, we had a new police officer who complained that the images were too graphic and disturbing, apparently, so we can't do that anymore. But I don't think they're in the job anymore.
All right.
But they're in the wrong job then, surely, if they think that.
I thought it was, when I first started, I was sort of sat down, my colleague sat me down with the body box and got all the photographs out and was showing me. And it really, really helped a lot, because it does help prepare you, and you do need that desensitizing before you go to your first body. And I think as well, going to your first one as soon as you can to sort of get it out of the way, because you want to know that, as much as you think, you know, I've got a strong stomach, I'm not squeamish, this sort of, you actually don't know how you're going to cope until you're in that situation. So it's always good to get it over and done with, so it's not the elephant in the room anymore. So,
but what about, images are one thing. I guess the thing that they're not prepared for is the smell.
The smell and the touch as well, the feel. I know it sounds quite bizarre, but it's surprising how cold a dead body does feel. And to the point where I had a bit of an issue the other day it was a few weeks ago now, where we had a chap who was found with head injuries in quite a bad way. He was taken to the intensive care unit, and nobody knew where he was because he had no phone or ID on him or anything. So I was asked to go and photograph him, and the fingerprint unit attended because they were going to fingerprint him so we'd know if he was on file, we could find out who he was, so we could get his family to him. And I remember he had abrasions and scarring on his knuckles. So I photographed him, as I say, he's lying in this intensive care bed, tried to get facial photographs as best as I can, which is actually difficult when somebody's lying down in the bed. And then went to touch his hand and was like, oh, his hands are warm. I'm not used to this. And then the guy from the fingerprint unit came along, and they went to pick his hand up to fingerprint him, and was like, oh, he's warm.
That's almost like the opposite, isn't it? You were used to the cold.
Absolutely. Yeah. So no, I'm much, and that's the other thing is as well, I'm much happier, I don't know if that's the right word. I prefer to deal with dead people because I am absolutely no good. I hate having to go to the hospital. I'm no good with people who are in pain and suffering. It really, really upsets me, and it freaks me out and nerves me. Whereas once they're dead, then, you know, nothing else can harm them anymore. And then your main priority is sort of doing all you can to find out what's happened to them for them, for their sake, obviously, and the families. But yeah, so I'm much more comfortable around dead people, I think.
Where does the job satisfaction lie for you in this?
It's when you know, even just so, it's not all about murders and the big major scenes. We obviously have bread and butter work, burglaries, car crime, that sort of stuff. And even now, if I get a fingerprint from a burglary that highlights an offender and somebody's locked up for it, that sense of satisfaction, that thrill never ever goes away. That is the best part of the job. Just generally knowing the passion that drives you is just wanting to help people. And that as well, again, if you can attend, say, a burglary where you've got a person who's incredibly distressed, because I mean, but if you've been burgled, you know the feeling, it's horrible.
Yeah, it really, I've been burgled twice, so I know. It's an awful feeling,
the violation, feeling a violation, upset and anger, and then the paranoia, because you're thinking, you know, I know for a fact I did when it happened to me, stood at the front window watching people walk past thinking, was it you? It's awful. Being able to spend time with somebody and reassure them and help them, again, that's what drives you, that's what motivates you, that's what gets you out of bed in the morning, gets you in work. Just knowing that justice has happened, that's a fantastic result.
Yeah. I mean, you're working, I mean, I know Manchester well, I've worked there for 9 years. It is one of the great, I mean, it's one of the great cities of the UK, clearly. One of the world places. Culturally, it's incredibly diverse. It is also terribly troubled in certain areas, particularly certain areas, but it's kind of a raw city, still has that energy that has carried through from the 19th century, it feels to me, through the 20th and into the 21st, that's still there, a sort of swagger. But a lot of it has a criminal mythology as well. There's an awful lot of mythologizing around the gangs that used to be there and still are. The whole, when I moved, you know, when I was thinking about moving to Manchester, the thing that used to pop in my mind was the name Gunchester, which was, you know, how it was associated in the 80s and 90s. So you must see things that, I mean, say if you were in the job, I don't know, rural Scotland, you probably, you know, you're seeing a lot more than someone who's in a similar role with Scottish police or something in the Highlands or something.
Absolutely. I think you're referring to the days, years gone by when it was known as Gunchester.
Gunchester, indeed.
We did have a lot of crime like that and still do. What I would say is I don't think we're any different from any city. I think most cities are the same. But yeah, absolutely. The sort of crime that we see, you wouldn't get in the sticks. So we do get things like shootings in particular and a lot of stabbings. So yeah, we do get a lot more that high level crime than somebody maybe in a rural setting would get. So it likewise as well, I suppose it depends where you're based. And I was advising a crime writer who'd asked me about somebody, what would happen if they drowned in the sea. That sort of thing, I've never experienced, so I couldn't comment on. So everyone's different areas are going to have different sort of crime levels, if you like.
The appeal of crime in rural areas, so crime fiction set in rural areas, where if you thought that all the crime fiction you read was reflective of real life, you wouldn't want to live in the Highlands of Scotland.
Who would want to be absolutely a Soko in Midsummer?
Yeah, exactly. Well, then again, maybe you look at those settings and is it not easy then to write about that because you haven't got then things like your CCTV, as we were talking earlier, going back to Agatha Christie's day, you know, maybe it's easier to write. In fact, yeah, I might suddenly change Myra and move her from a different force. I might send her to, the back of beyond.
Isle of Man.
That might make book three easier. She's going to have a transfer. Thanks for that idea, guys.
She can go on holiday and it'll be a crime. So every week on the podcast, I ask a completely random question that's not related to anything about what you do or your job or your book or anything. So my random question this week is, do you collect anything?
Books, as you can see behind me. Books, and I've recently just started getting back into crystals as well, because my teenage daughter's become quite obsessed with crystals. And we've a lovely shop near us that sell a lovely wild array and variety. So books and crystals, I would say.
Fantastic.
I think you have to be careful, don't you? If you tell somebody you collect something, this happened to a friend of mine, she dropped it in conversation that she quite liked penguins. And then every Christmas and birthday she gets ceramic penguins, fluffy penguins, penguins on cushion covers.
Saying it's like when you were a kid and you'd get something new for tea. If you made the mistake of saying I like that, then you would get force fed it nearly every night and you were sick of it. So it's a bit the same thing, isn't it? No, Natalie, I think you're right. Don't tell people what you like.
Yeah, I think I've done that to my children actually, because and then eventually they'll say you know how we have fajitas every week? Can we have a week off now?
Absolutely.
I want to put it on record, though, that I do collect Bitcoin. So if anyone wants to...
I thought you were going to say golf clubs.
No, that's true, too. That's very, very true. I mean, I've got to ask, obviously, the writing is, you know, you're in a position of being part-time. You've got basically the two jobs you love doing, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. What else do you do to relax?
I don't know, really. I suppose just normal stuff, reading, television, spending time with family. Pre-COVID, I like to go to the gym. Just normal stuff, really. Very dull and boring. I also like gardening as well. So this time of year makes me a bit sad when I can see all the flowers starting to die off and autumn's on its way. I happily fast forward straight through to the next spring now.
I know what you mean. The thing about gardening, though, in crime books is that it, you know, no one ever goes out gardening without discovering something terrible.
Yeah, watch out what you dig up in the garden.
Yeah.
Kate, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. If people want to get hold of you for your advice and indeed to learn more about what you do and your books, where do they find you?
So I'm on Twitter, I've got a Facebook author page, or they can email me at contact@katebendelow.co.uk.
It's been.
I'm also on Instagram as well, although I don't really understand that. It's get my daughter to set that up for me. So.
That's quite a common thing. A lot of our authors say that. They say, well, I'm there, but I don't know what I do with it.
Yeah, if we could only master it. Well, look, it's been an absolute pleasure. We've learned so much.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, our
very welcome,
and we wish you every success with, well, how do we offer?
Yeah, we look forward to book two.
How do we wish you success on the day job? I don't know, but we wish you success.
Oh, thanks very much. That's very kind of you. Thank you both.
Kate Bendelow, who has made a big impression on me in the sense that, you know, to be excited to go in to do the sort of work she does takes a special kind of person.
I agree. Yeah, it was fascinating talking to her.
Absolutely. So let's, you know, we'll wrap up the show shortly. But what have you reflect on this week? Because I was making, you know, it's one of those weeks where I was feeling like I was making good progress, and then, you know, illness has struck, and I'm sort of grinding to a halt somewhat.
Trying to think. So we've had a reasonably busy week, haven't we? Because we had, because of bloody Scotland, you know, whenever we go away, there's always a bit of a backlog in sort of the everyday stuff that we have to do.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of ferrying of children to and back to school and back. And you had a fun match in Manchester, didn't you?
Oh, well, we lost to West Ham, and then we subsequently lost to I can barely bring myself to say it, Aston Villa at the weekend. I wasn't at that game, thank goodness, but I was at the Wednesday one. And I'm due to go on Wednesday again for Champions League, but I don't think I'm going to be in any fit state. So, look, it's busy. It always is. And we have so many books coming out in the next few weeks. We've had a lot of effort behind some of those autumn releases. Because,
yeah.
I mean, with every book we release, we make new contacts within the industry, whether it's bookshops, bloggers, that sort of thing. And so the network is widening, and the number of people we need to liaise. I mean, I'm struck by just how many books you sent off this week.
I think I posted a picture on Twitter of the pile of books. This was Ollie Jarvis's The Genesis Inquiry. So Ollie has, he's got a sort of a freelance PR consultant working with us on his book. And she sent me a list of media contacts and bloggers and reviewers to send the book out to. And I've already had to ask twice now for more books from Clay's for these sort of advanced copies. And the pile was about waist high.
It was.
And so when I went into our local post office, the ladies there now know us really well. And they see me in the queue and I can see that look of fear they have on their faces. It's like, oh, gosh, it's the book lady. And I went in and I said, I'm really sorry, I've got so many books for you. And they were so nice. They said, don't worry, this is our job, this is what we do. But it did take her about 20 minutes. And the people behind me in the queue were looking...
murderous.
Oh, they were.
And imagine if they've just come off a petrol queue and they go to the post office now.
It's a good job they don't sell petrol in the post office.
No, it is. It is. So, I mean, you know, even the space of a week, we couldn't have done the journey to Scotland if the petrol or the diesel had
run out. It doesn't bear thinking about, does it?
No, I've got sort of 2/3 of a tank left. But I'm starting, in my mind, I'm rationing it. Obviously, I don't feel well enough to go out at the moment anyway. And that's actually a small mercy. But, you know, getting up to see my family, even 100 miles away in round trip terms, you know, you've got to ration those visits now.
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky. I managed to fill the tank just before the panic set in. And but, you know, I've been calculating how many school trips can I do and get food while I'm doing the school trips before we run out. Because our nearest shop that sells food is a 3-mile walk away.
Yeah.
So if it comes to it and there's no petrol in the whole of the UK, we're going to have to walk for 3 miles to buy food.
Yeah, 6-mile round trip.
6-mile round trip.
Yeah, alternatively, we could go down to the wharf and ask hitch a lift on a boat, maybe.
No, I did suggest that to my eldest child when, because we did walk to the shop fairly recently just to see how far it was. And I said, we should just stick our thumb out because it's along the canal, the walk is. It's a lovely walk. And, you know, hitch a lift. And I said, we'll get there about the same time as if we were walking. And he said, no, don't do that, mother.
Of course he said that. He's risk averse in so many ways. Anyway, no, so it's going to be an interesting week with that shadow over the whole country in terms of, you know, what people can do and the stress of trying to find petrol. There's none in our local town.
No, I was there this morning and both petrols, the main petrol stations, there is another one which I didn't pass, but both were deserted.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I've got a big agenda of editing to do and, it, you know, should the voice recover and I'm not, if I don't have the COVID or whatever, then I should get back to recording. But, you know, it holds things up significantly when you cannot perform sounding like this. It's simple as that.
I could do it. I could be you. I could go down deep.
You could, but you tried doing a
Oompa Loompa.
With the way I feel at the moment, I couldn't possibly do a Merseyside accent if I tried.
It's chicken just, and a can of Coke?
Can of what? Chicken and a can of Coke.
See, you can just about do it.
Yeah, but I couldn't sustain it for more than about 5 minutes. Which means I think we should come to an end now. Next week, who have we got lined up?
Next week. Now, I've completely gone blank. Of course, it is going to be the next book we're publishing, Harry Fisher.
Wonderful. Be Sure Your Sins.
Be Sure Your Sins. The reason I went blank is because I was trying to arrange the interview with Harry and I said, oh, it'll be the week after next because your book is publishing after that. And he replied and said, I think you've lost a week. Is there some sort of Staffordshire time zone you're in?
Yeah,
so
pretty much.
I was a bit confused. So, yes, it'll be Harry Fisher next week.
That's wonderful. Harry will be a great guest and it is a fabulous book. Blew my socks off when I read it. And increasingly, that's the case with the books that we're publishing. You know, we are.
He hasn't got many socks left.
No, I don't. You're right, because you keep losing them. We're in a basket full of odds and sods that come out of the wash and never find their partners.
Now, yes, don't get me started on the odd sock pile. We have a massive pile of odd socks.
It's one of the foibles of running Hobeck books. Anyway, we digress. Thank you so much for putting up with my voice.
And putting up with mine.
Rebecca Collins's voice. Thank you for joining us. Don't forget to go to our website, www.hobeck.net, for further details about our authors and all the products that we have out there, all the books.
And one last thing, we have a competition coming soon, so details of that will be revealed next week.
They will. They will. Been busy creating a wonderful themed competition, which I'm sure we'll all get excited about. I want to win this prize.
I want to win every single prize, and I never do.
Yeah, just as well. Anyway, thank you for joining us. Have a wonderful, creative week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.